Call the meeting to order of the Higher Education and Career Readiness Policy and Finance Committee. To begin with, we do have a roll call, and we don't have, I'm reading some notes here. We're not going to take a roll call. But anyway, we do have a quorum, is what I was trying to say. And we have a couple of sets of minutes to have you look at and approve. Need a motion for the minutes from February the 1st. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Okay. Representative Omar moves. Any questions? Not all those in favor of the February 1st minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Minutes have been approved. And then February 7th, minutes from February 7th. Representative Schultz, any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Come on.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Thank you. All right, minutes have been approved, and we go right to our business of the day. First bill up is House File 607, and Representative Schultz will be the motion would indicate that this will be held over for possible inclusion. Would you like to make the motion yourself, please?
Sure. I move House File 607.
All right.
Okay.
You can begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a grant program that will help low-income families and students afford a public education at our 4- and 2-year Minsky and University of Minnesota higher education institutions, and this has a companion bill in the Senate. And other states right now are also moving forward on legislation that's very similar. So the grant would help cover the difference between the tuition and fees, and would exclude any amounts they get through Pell Grants, state grants, or other scholarships, so it would pay that difference. And it would be, I don't have the fiscal note on this, it won't be ready until tomorrow. But I do have information on the cost that they've estimated in New York, if people would like information on that. And as you guys know, students are struggling to pay for college, 2-year and 4-year. And the average debt load in Minnesota is around $29,000 after they graduate. Right now at the University of Minnesota Duluth, where I teach, we even have a food shelf for students, which is becoming more popular around the country as students, even though they're working, are struggling to pay their living expenses. I believe 13% of college students are even homeless, and 20% report on a survey that was done in Wisconsin of being hungry and not having enough money for food. And so you see that it's more common that universities are starting food shelves for their own students. So the affordability is a problem. I'm calling this bill sort of the Minnesota Miracle Squared bill, where we invested a lot in our K-12 system, which was the Minnesota Miracle. I think we need to start thinking about investing in higher ed to make sure we have a world-class workforce that attracts businesses to Minnesota and that we can compete globally in cutting-edge technology, STEM areas, even in liberal arts. So I'm moving this bill forward. I hope we can talk about this after we get a fiscal note as well. In the state of New York, their estimate, which is a very similar program, was $163 million. And they're covering a lot more people in their program, so ours would be much less than that, I hope.
That's an annual cost?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And it's only for students in Minnesota.
It's only for residents of Minnesota. There's also information in the bill about needing a certain GPA. So the students would have to meet that GPA to be eligible for the grant. It would go through the FAFSA system to check on eligibility. And they have to maintain a GPA of 2.5 on a 4.0 scale and maintain academic progress in this area. Otherwise, they would lose the grant.
Okay, questions? Oh, Representative Haley, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. When you mentioned the New York estimate was $163 million, from Minnesota, do you know how many students this would serve?
I would know if we had the physical. I tried to delay this bill hearing, but we wanted, apparently this bill wanted to be heard today. So the physical note will contain that, and I will send that out to the committee once I get it, which should estimate the number of students that would be eligible. So it's not, but I know that if we pay, if the state of Minnesota paid for everyone who was eligible to enroll in college, and we paid for all college expenses for any income limit, the estimates I've seen, it would be $734 million. That's for everybody. This grant is income-based, and it has a GPA requirement and a residency requirement. And it only is for public institutions, so the University of Minnesota and MinSCU institutions. So the top limit is $700 million to pay for everybody's college costs. And that's regardless of financial aid. New York's, it was $940,000 households had college eligible students, but I didn't have a number on their income, number in the households that would qualify based on their income. But we should know that tomorrow.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many times can they renew that grant? Is it renewable then?
The way that the bill is written, it is a statutory appropriation, meaning the program would automatically receive the funds required to provide the grant. But Mr. Williams might be able to have more information on that.
Mr. Chair, to the best of my knowledge, there's no limits written in language in the bill, so as to how many times a particular student could renew a grant under the program.
Thank you.
Okay, here's some information, Chair. So it says in Subdivision 6, the grant may be renewed annually, so the student could reapply for the grant if they met the eligibility requirements.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about New York. Are they currently doing this program, and do they have a history then in New York of if it's working, basically, are people getting through school quicker? Are they getting through school with less debt and issues such as that?
This is being proposed by the New York Assembly, so they haven't implemented it yet. And they phase in the income requirement. They start with $100,000 annually and in 3 years move up to the $125,000. So our bill is a little bit different. But, no, they have not yet implemented the program.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Pryor, do you have a follow-up? Okay. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, do you have any estimates on kind of how future costs would go as enrollments, I think, would likely shift from private schools to public schools if this program were to go into place, which would increase the cost of the program? Do you have any idea of predictions or how extensive those shifts would be for fiscal planning?
Sure.
I'm just estimating, guessing this, a guesstimate. I think there would be some shift, but I think if students really wanted to go to a private school and the private schools maintain their scholarship programs, that they would still continue to go to those private schools even though there was money available for publics. But I'm sure there's going to be some shift, but I don't see it as significant. And we want more residents to be going to our public institutions. And at one time, the state covered a third of the tuition cost. And over the last 20 years, we've seen a significant decline. So in some regards, our public institutions are becoming private institutions because of the low level of state funding. And I think we have to get back to a point where we're helping our state institutions and helping students afford college.
Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, you mentioned that we want more students to go to our public institutions. I think it's great for students to go to public institutions. I went to a public institution. I went to the University of Minnesota. But why do you think it's better for students to go to public institutions than private institutions?
We want our Minnesota. I think the argument is that the Minnesota residents are the non-residents. We want to have those slots available to more of our Minnesota residents rather than non-residents going to our public schools and institutions. And this grant would give them, allow them an opportunity to go to our public institutions in Minnesota. The option could be they could go to a public institution or a private outside of the state. This may help keep our Minnesota residents in Minnesota going to our schools and hopefully staying in Minnesota once they graduate.
Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, are you concerned that this is going to, in some ways, box students that are maybe not the highest achieving, but certainly college, you know, material students, kind of box them out of college in Minnesota as enrollment shifts to public schools from private schools, which I think, you know, you didn't seem to think like it would be that large of a shift. I think it would be a pretty extensive shift if you could save that amount of money, if you could essentially go to free college at public schools. I think it'd be a really extensive shift. And as those students take up slots at public schools, obviously the public schools are going to take the highest performing applicants. Are you concerned that some middle of the road students might be boxed out of college, out of our public schools, because it's filled with all of these people that are coming in from private schools?
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that based on the demographics and the population, that we're going to have more open slots in our public institutions for students because of this, the change in our aging demographics. So I don't see that as a problem. I also think that, I think it's a good question. I think where we can look to see when we increased and implemented the state grant program to see how much it shifted once that program was implemented, and we can ask for that information to see what the shift was after we implemented the state grant program to give us an idea of what to expect if this was actually implemented.
Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, who do you kind of see as the target of this program? Who do you think it really benefits the most?
Schultz?
Well, I think it benefits students and their families to help afford schools. So those families who are not available to set aside savings for their dependents. And I think it also benefits those students who are independent because that threshold is $75,000 or less to afford school. So many students will qualify through FAFSA, the FAFSA process in Pell Grants, but there's still quite a bit of expense in terms of tuition and fees that they cannot afford. So it will definitely help those students who are middle income, low income, afford college and have an opportunity to go to college.
Christensen, are you done?
Yeah, a couple more questions, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, do you have any kind of an idea on, so I know you don't know kind of the exact cost of this. Do you have an estimate? Do you think it'll kind of fit within our current budget in the legislature of the state of Minnesota, or do you think we'll need to raise taxes in order to pay for it?
I think if we think long-term and not short-term, that this will have a huge payoff to the state if we invest in educating our workforce and meaning in terms of bringing businesses here, having people be able qualified for jobs that make more money than they pay more in tax to the state, so it would increase our revenue. So I think we have to think this is a long-term investment, like our Minnesota Miracle. This would be the second wave of that, but focused on higher ed. I really wanted to wait and present this after the fiscal note, so I would have it. I'm a data person, so I like to have that information, so I apologize that that note wasn't ready today. But I can give you, I don't know where it's going to fit in the budget you guys develop, but I hope we can have those conversations early so we can start thinking about what sources of revenue we could use or raise to invest in Minnesota and our workforce.
Christensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This last one. Well, I just think it's really important that we're thinking about, that we have an idea of how much this is going to cost. I think it's important, obviously within the amount of revenue that the state of Minnesota is currently raising. I mean, I don't really see, I mean, it's obvious that this will be a very, very expensive proposition. I understand, obviously education is critically important. It's an investment, but, I don't really see that there's a way to do this without raising taxes, and I'm just, kind of interested in what kind of tax increases you think would be the best way to pay for this.
Schultz?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not going to go on the record saying that we might need a tax increase. I think there's other ways to pay for higher education, that we can reduce our spending in other areas or become more efficient in other ways. But I think once you get, you have your target and you have your budget, we are doing very well economically. And my concern is that other states will move forward in helping fund their workforce, and we will lose out on attracting businesses to Minnesota.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. One more question. So I think, you know, I'm encouraged by your openness to reductions in spending. So I'm just curious about what some of your ideas are for spending reductions, because they'd have to be obviously really significant spending reductions in order to pay for this.
Well, we spend a lot right now on health and human services, so I think that's an area where we could look at. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on insurance, and right now that's not really working for our Minnesota population in terms of getting affordable health care. So I think there are savings in health and human services that we can move from there if we make some substantial reforms, and your party is in control, so I'm eager to work with you on those reforms, that we can move that money over to higher education.
I know you have a testifier. We have a couple of more questions coming, and then we'll have the testifier. Is that okay? Representative Heitzman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see in, I think it's subdivision 5, satisfactory academic progress. There's some discussion of some thresholds there for folks that they must be, maintain at least a C-plus during their first academic year. And I'm wondering, a question actually had come up in the Minsky system, at what point would you maybe step in and say we need to make an adjustment? And I'm wondering if in this language there are some protections that are built in, like say for example, you have a student that does maintain a C-plus average, yet they continue to take a class over and over and over again. Does a taxpayer continue to pay for that student for whatever reason? I'm not sure what the issue might be, but are there any protections there or anything built into this language?
Schultz?
Mr. Chair, Representative. So I don't know, as a professor, I don't know why a student would want to keep taking the same class over and over and over. I mean, sometimes they take it over if they fail a class or they get a D and they want to increase it to a C+. And some institutions do have limits on how many times they can retake a class or and how they can retake that class. So I would rely on the institution's policy to help us guide us on maintaining the 2.5 GPA. I don't think it's in the interest of students to keep retaking a class.
Heitzman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, for example, if you have a student and anybody that has taken a college class has noticed folks that, for whatever reason, you know, maybe they are not interested that semester and they move on to the next semester and maybe again they're not interested and they continue to just drop out of the class. It may be personal reasons, or maybe they, who knows what the reason might be, but wouldn't it make sense to have something built into the language that would allow some kind of a control there, rather than just continuing without any consequences, a student to continue to just drop out and then take it again and drop out? That's going to be a very significant cost, and if there's no control mechanism built in, you know, the institution may, as you suggested, have a policy, or maybe they would just continue to allow that to happen, and there's nothing there to protect the taxpayer.
An example might be somebody going into medical school and their grades aren't quite good enough. They'd have to retake and hopefully improve the grade. I assume that's one case where you'd want to take it over at least once.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, so this is only for undergraduate education. This is, does not apply to graduate education or professional schools like the School of Medicine. And this is geared for full-time students. So students that are struggling in one class are often struggling in other classes and would have a really hard time maintaining a 2.5 if they are struggling, even if they retake that class. So I guess I'm not as concerned that we would have hundreds of cases like that, or even one case where, I mean, I think it's okay to have a student try to retake a class. But if that semester they fall below a 2.5, they're not eligible for the grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, There's got to be some limit to the generosity of the taxpayer, and there's got to be some opportunity for them to take responsibility if they're not completing a class, yet maybe overall they maintain a C-plus average. They could, under your language, continue to take a class, it's paid for, drop out, and that process could just go on and on. Where are the controls? I don't see any here in the language.
Schultz?
Well, I'm happy to work with you on that language, Representative. I'm tightening it, but I think if they're not considered a full-time student, they drop below. If they drop that class is not considered in their credit load. So they would not be able to continue and wouldn't be eligible for the grant.
All right, Representative Pryor, you're next.
Thank you. I was thinking more about this. So it's this idea, though, that we are then doing something that would be in the country, you know, some of the first adapters of this kind of program. And so I guess I would, there's two questions I actually have right now, if I may. It seems to me that it would be good to follow and see, you know, which institutions students are choosing to go that are getting these grants to cover full tuition, and that you kind of like the measures of success, so that we would know whether or not what we intend to do with this is working or not. If there's not other models that you know give us that data right now to say that this is a good investment, a good bet on our students, because you know based on what we've heard already, we know that you know there's needy students that are falling behind, that are not able to stay on track for graduation, and they're the ones that are going to debt and are not being able to benefit from our post-secondary institutions, and that we need those kids. We need them to get good educations, and we need them to do it in a timely manner. And then my second question, if I may, is I know that if I had all the statutes here, I could look it up, but if you don't mind just letting me know and summarizing, when you say satisfactory academic progress, and actually I think this may have been what Representative Heisman was trying to get at, is to know that students are on track for graduating on time and not wasting time in college. And that's what I think maybe one of the things that we want to make sure that we're addressing. And I think probably that statute would let us know, you know, if this is being covered right now.
So I think Mr. Williams is ready to answer that question.
So Mr. Chair and Representative Pryor, the existing definition of satisfactory academic progress for the purpose of other state financial aid programs cross-references to the federal regulation on this topic related to federal financial aid programs. I'm not familiar with the details, but I know that there's like requirements that you complete a certain number of the required credits over a particular period of time and in a certain number of years. And if the committee would be okay with it, I can follow up offline with sort of more details on what the definition of satisfactory academic progress is.
Representative Pryor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, so I understand the concern, and I think right now, at least at my institution, University of Minnesota Duluth, we see poor rates of graduation in 4 years and the higher levels of student debt on average than the national average because students are working so many hours, so they have to delay graduation or they can't be full-time, they have to be part-time. So I think helping them pay for schooling, we're going to see huge improvements in graduation rates 4 years and GPA levels as well.
And I guess that would be what I would like to see in the legislation, though, is that we'd be able to document that change. And so that we know that if we're making this choice, if we're making this investment, that we are getting kind of the return on the investment that we expected.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, so the universities for accreditation purposes document all of this information, so we would be able to, if once it's implemented, we can go back to iPads, get all that information, and evaluate the effectiveness of this program if it was implemented, definitely.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Pryor's comment, what I was specifically driving at is in the Minsky system, Minn State now, if you take a class and you're a student who happens to have some aid, there's a threshold to protect the taxpayer. So if you take it twice and you are not able to complete the class, currently you don't get help with the third time. You'd be on your own dime. And that would be somehow, that would be to encourage folks to make sure that they're not taking advantage of a system, and that's not present in this language.
Okay, any other, maybe we should call on your testifier now?
That's sure, the, thank you.
Joseph Wolf, is that, that's who he is, right?
Yeah, yes.
Good. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself with the record, and then proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Trin Ornis, committee members, for allowing me to testify, and I am glad to be back in front of you today. My name is Joseph Wolf. I'm a student at Minnesota State University Mankato, and I'm the state chair for Students United, an organization which represents all Minnesota State University students. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 607. This bill would provide much-needed financial support for state university students. Many of the students I represent struggle to pay for their education, both during school and after graduation. Despite taking steps to financial tuition, books, and living expenses with work and available financial aid, the average Minnesota University student graduates with over $31,000 in student loan debt. But it is not uncommon for state university graduates to leave our institutions with over $40,000 or even $50,000 in debt. I personally am above the debt average and owe $39,600 in student loan debt. Many of my friends and classmates take as many credits as possible in order to graduate on time while also working one or two part-time jobs, with some working over 40 hours a week. Many state university students receive little or no family assistance. As you can see, students have to borrow as much as it takes to complete their degree and set them on the right path for their career. This bill would provide a much-needed grant for students and would reduce debt, college debt. Thank you, Representative Schultz, and all the sponsors for this, for supporting state university students in this bill. And I am happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Wolf? I thank you for being here and for waiting, being patient. I think we have probably discussed the bill extensively, and we have Representative Leon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, I do appreciate you bringing this forward. Now, I will say I'm not a big fan of free college. I just don't see that it's completely sustainable, you know, in the long run. I think people do have to be paying in some, you know, some of their own money for this. But I really appreciate you bringing this forward. I appreciate you looking at different solutions, different ways to help people achieve an education, help the state grow its economy. And furthermore, when we're talking about, you know, how much is this going to cost? Are we going to have to raise taxes? What are the protections for the taxpayers? Well, I think that's kind of missing the point here, because ultimately we need to get a handle on tuition. We need to get a handle on student debt. It's the number one source of personal debt in this country, and it's crushing our economy, so to speak. So I think really the point is the real protections for the taxpayers, the real protections for how much this bill is going to cost is with us. It's with the legislature, and it's with this committee. And so when we have the systems coming in, MNSCU, or Minnesota State, the U of M, the privates, we need to be asking them, what are you doing with these dollars, whether it's tuition dollars, whether it's state appropriations, are they going into administration, are they going into bonuses, or are they going into the classrooms, are they going into students' actual education? So really that's for our job to do. And again, I just appreciate you bringing this bill forward and looking at different ways to help people get an education and help help our economy grow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any final words?
Sure. So this doesn't make college free, because students still have to pay for their living expenses if it's in a dorm, and they have an opportunity cost of going to college, because if they cannot work full-time, that is their opportunity cost. So it's definitely, it helps them, but it's not completely free.
The chair moves that House File 607 be held over for possible inclusion. And thank you, Representative Schultz.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 794, Representative Daly. This This is the first for you?
Yes, it is, Chair Nornes. And I do have cookies when we're done today.
Representative Albright.
Given the nature and circumstance of Representative Haley's presentation today, and hope I'm being assured that there is an offering being provided to the chair.
I don't know for sure, but we'll ask.
I would hope that we would find favor with the presenter. Mr. Chair, it's always been my understanding that the offering is made before the service.
Well, we can pause for a moment. Just don't leave the room, that's all.
I wasn't sure of the procedural form.
We don't have this happen very often, so we don't really have a procedure. But we're thankful. I think we can eat and listen at the same time.
Thank you, Chair Nornes, the members. Before I introduce House File 794, I have one short amendment. I wondered if you wanted me to explain that first.
Sure. Go ahead.
Amendment that is in your packet on page 1, line 10, deletes Minnesota. And this is just a reference to open up this particular legislation to benefit all graduates working in Minnesota, not just those who completed their education in Minnesota.
Just bear with me. Okay.
I should mention that the cookies are from Hanisch Bakery, which was voted the best bakery in Minnesota. If our meeting was in the morning, I would have bought donuts, so next time we can try a different treat.
All right. Any questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is included.
Thank you, Chair Nornes and members. I appreciate this opportunity to present my first bill this session, House File 794. I'll give a short preview and my reasons for supporting this bill, and then I'll turn it over to Lutheran Social Services, who are the program providers and implementers of this program. Last week, you were provided with testimony regarding the pilot program that was passed in 2015 to address student loan debt. Due to the successful outcomes of this pilot, we are requesting authorization for continuation of this individualized student loan repayment counseling program. I know we all share the value for higher education, and we also share concern over rising tuition costs and the resulting high levels of student debt that burden our graduates. As you can read in the handout, 70% of those graduating from college have student debt, and the average student debt loan in Minnesota for graduates is over $30,000. I want to just tell you five reasons why I'm excited about this bill. First of all, I believe in personal accountability and responsibility. This is not a loan forgiveness program. This is helping our students take responsibility for their debt, and it helps them with a repayment plan that is within their income levels and their budget. Number two, this is a proven program. We have experience from the pilot, and the data shows excellent results, and our other testifiers will speak to that. Number three, this is a proactive approach. It gets at the problem before issues get our graduates in trouble. It prevents default, provides financial stability so that our graduates can pursue jobs, pursue housing, car purchases, families, without injuring their credit rating. Number four, I believe there's a high return on investment. With a little bit of money invested, this will pay off for economic growth for our graduates and for our state. And number five, this serves those in greatest need. The student debt problem disproportionately affects students of color, low-income students, and first-generation college students. And this program aims to target those individuals. If there aren't any questions for me, I'll turn it over to the panel.
Okay. Any questions? Otherwise, who's next? Do you want to identify yourself for the record, please, and then give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Rissavy, and I'm the Senior Director of Financial Services at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. First, I'd like to thank Representative Haley for her work on this bill, as well as the co-authors, Representative Nornes, Lean, Daniels, Heinzman, Jessup, Christensen, Pryor, and Zerwas. Ms. Grimes and I testified at this committee last week regarding the pilot program that the Minnesota State Legislature created in May of 2015 to serve Minnesotans struggling with student loan payments, of which LSS was selected through a competitive request for proposals process. Today I will briefly review how the program works, the key pilot outcomes, and the reasons why this bill is essential to supporting Minnesota student loan borrowers and our state's economy. 14,000 Minnesotans a year defaulted on their student loans in the last report from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Defaulting on student loans is devastating on a borrower's financial life, with major impacts on credit scores. Nearly all of these defaults could have been prevented through various repayment options, such as income-driven repayment, consolidation, if people understood them and moved forward with an option that best fit their situation. As a result of the legislation passed in 2015, 981 borrowers were served, and from 60 counties across Minnesota. After counseling, the delinquent borrowers brought over $9 million of student loan into good standing. Out of all the borrowers served, 97% developed a monthly budget plan, 86% feel more confident regarding their repayment, and 80% say payments are more affordable a year after implementing the changes with counseling. In the pilot, we are seeing a need to serve Minnesota residents who went to school in neighboring states, particularly Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Iowa, being the most frequent Minnesota residents who went to school in some of these neighboring states. And the full report that you received and the one-pager you received also provides additional information regarding the program and the pilot outcomes. So borrowers are referred to the service by many different ways, financial aid offices at campuses, the credit unions or banks, friends of people who have been served, or through some other outreach that we've done. Due to the disproportionate impact of student debt in students of color, we've given focused outreach to partner with Minnesota campuses, such as Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, Minneapolis Community and Technical College, whose student population includes a high percentage of students of color, and first-generation college students. During the pilot, we've also focused our outreach and had strong success with other Minnesota schools that are working hard to address some of the highest default rates in the state. One example is Central Lakes College, who asked our team to join efforts with their student loan default task force. Borrowers meet in person or over the phone with a certified financial counselor who has received intensive training in both the technical aspects of distressed student loans and behavior change counseling techniques. Counseling is provided to borrowers regarding their complete financial situation, pulling credit reports, budgeting, addressing all the income, expenses, debt, including other housing or credit card debt, as well as understanding all of the federal, state, private student loans that's owed by the borrower and the repayment options that are available to them. Then an action plan is developed that includes sustainable changes in financial practices and prioritizes student loan repayment. I'd like to share one example of someone who benefited from student loan repayment counseling. Jason is a 29-year-old from Duluth, and he came into LSS 275 days delinquent, but not yet in default on his student loans. He was married this past September, and his family would like to buy a house. Jason and the financial counselor contacted the loan servicer together, requested forbearance to stop the default, give a few months to determine the best repayment plan. The counselor laid out all of his options and discussed different scenarios as far as tax filing status, income changes. Jason avoided the default that would have occurred without the appointment with the counselor because he did not know what to do and had no contact with the servicer. Together, they developed an action plan that included bringing student loans current and steps to achieve their goal of home ownership by reducing debt and improving the credit. There is a great demand within our communities for this service. We continually hear from loan officers, realtors, and individuals themselves that student loan debt is a barrier to home ownership. I was just at a meeting this morning with members of the community who are working with first-time home buyers, and they said that student loan debt was the number one issue holding people back. It's a major barrier for people who seek to become homeowners. I've also heard from other partners in the community who are employment counselors that is a defaulted student loan is one of the things that is holding people back from returning to college to finish their degree because of that loan that's in default. With continued funding, we can serve more aspiring home buyers, more aspiring business owners, conducting additional outreach and service in communities of color, further expanding the service to people throughout Minnesota who are struggling with student loan debt. So based on the need we've seen throughout the state and the successful track record we've had in getting borrowers back on track, we hope the legislature will continue to support this model by providing borrowers with the information and the support needed. We can prevent student loan debt from inhibiting the growth of Minnesota's economy and derailing the borrower's life goals for which they sought higher education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the benefits of the service. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Grimes, are you ready?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just be brief. I'm Tricia Grimes. I'm a volunteer with Lutheran Social Service. Before I retired, I was the legislative liaison for the Office of Higher Education at the state. And many years before that, I was a nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the Minnesota House working on higher education. I just think this is really important. It's too easy to fall into thinking that there's not much we can do to help students with their loans other than loan forgiveness. And this is a relatively low-cost way that borrowers can be helped. And they can get back on track because there are a variety of repayment plans that can help them. One of the things many borrowers do not know is that, for example, if they work for any level of government, state, federal, local, county, and if they work for a nonprofit, they are eligible for public service loan forgiveness. This is the one of the kind, if they're legislative staff, for example, they're eligible for public service loan forgiveness after they've been paying on their loans for 10 years. And a lot of people don't know that, borrowers don't know that, and sometimes just knowing an option like that can really help them. The other option that borrowers really need to know about is called income-based repayment, where if their income is very low, their payments are very low. And as their income increases over time, their payments increase. But all of these are things that can help them avoid the bad consequences to credit that come with delinquency and default. I urge you to support this bill.
All right. Thank you. I had a third name. Is anyone else testifying, or is it? Okay. Representative Haley.
I just wanted to note that we left the fiscal portion off the bill because we wanted to hopefully have this put to the Finance Committee and when they get their budget targets. So there's a range on your handout of $150,000 to $375,000 annually, depending on the number of borrowers we can serve. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Questions from members? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haley, thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is an observation, and I'm not sure if Ms. Grimes or the representative might respond to it, but oftentimes we see these individuals at the time of need after they have indentured themselves with massive amounts of debt, chasing after a dream. And I fully understand that and appreciate that. But I'm just wondering if at some point we might not think about inserting this conversation possibly at the time of a loan origination to the extent that there is an awareness in terms of you do understand the opportunity, but also the responsibility for taking on this debt, what it will obligate you to, but also, in a sense, provide them with resources to prevent them from becoming an island and wondering what to do. So I'm wondering if you might respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, you raise a really good question. There is some degree of financial literacy required to be provided in Minnesota in orientation when students are starting school. And before they take out their first student loan, 85% of student loans in Minnesota are federal student loans. And before they take out their first federal student loan, they are required to go through something called entrance counseling. The problem is that many students do a very human thing. They think, well, that's 4 years from now. And they don't really pay close enough attention. Now, places like Central Lakes College that try to build the financial literacy pretty rigorously into their orientation really talk to the students about borrowing as little as possible and trying to live frugally and minimize their expenses. But it's not always easy to get the students' attention that they ought to be minimizing their student loan debt. But you raise a very good question.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Albright?
I just congratulate the efforts that you've made thus far, and I would just wholeheartedly endorse this program.
Any other questions? Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many organizations would qualify to apply for the grant in Minnesota?
Ms. Grants?
Thank you. When they did the request for proposal in 2015, there were two organizations that applied. Lutheran Social Service, frankly, has the largest statewide reach in the area of financial counseling. It has offices in all 87 counties.
Thank you.
Representative Pelosi.
Yeah. Ms. Grams, can you explain who does the counseling at Central Lakes up front for those students?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what Ms. Grimes was speaking to is a college like Central Lakes has really engaged with our team to not only provide the referrals to our financial counselors to graduates, they have engaged with us with having us come to grad wrap fairs, the graduation fairs. They have had us come in and speak to some of the students who are currently enrolled to speak to some of the pitfalls we've seen with those who have run into trouble with student loans later on to try to avoid some of that. So it is really a referral to us, and then we've had some financial education.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, so there's no one who's employed at the college that does the counseling. You have to come in and do it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, the financial aid at the office at the college does try to educate borrowers about loans and about what their obligations are. The financial literacy training that's part of orientation tends to be separate from the financial aid office at the college. One of the things that Lutheran Social Service brings to the table is they work with the borrower on their whole financial situation, not just their student loans. Sometimes credit card trouble and other kinds of trouble can make it contribute to a borrower's sense of hopelessness that they can do anything about their loans. Looking at their whole financial situation can really help get them back on track.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Graves, I'm trying to get to the point that we are funding employees on campus to do the counseling. So if we're funding employees on campus to do the counseling, and you just said that they were doing the counseling up front, then we have to contract with an outside entity to do more counseling? I'm trying to figure out who's doing the counseling, the paid public employee or you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, to really, to some extent, both. The financial aid staff at the colleges tend to have very heavy workloads. There are a lot of federal rules and regulations they have to abide by. They do what they can, but they tend to not have enough staff to do extensive financial counseling with individual students.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I knew you'd get to that point, and I appreciate it. So we're underfunding the counselors at the campus level who really should be doing this for every student, and now we're contracting for an outside entity to come in. But the outside entity would have a limited amount of staff. So what we really might want to start focusing on would be campus by campus and making sure we have it available on every campus to the extent that is needed, particularly in times of historic debt. You don't need to answer. I think I just have.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is regarding, we haven't talked about it yet today, is about three counseling sessions. Does your bill talk about three counseling sessions? I believe in the past you've talked about not being reimbursed for the third counseling session, then it would seem that those would be really complicated cases. Could you talk a little bit about how this bill handles that?
Who wants to answer that?
Thank you, Representative Chair Nornes, Representative. The current legislation with the pilot did limit to two sessions, and there were situations that were pretty complicated cases that people needed three appointments to follow up on various complex cases. So in the current legislation, I don't believe that we're changing that. So I believe it's two, but I could look into that. Yeah.
Representative Haley?
It's just two sessions right now.
Okay.
Representative
Bernardi.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a very serious issue, and I like, I hate to have to be downstream, and I would rather have there be more support for our colleges and our students so that they don't have to get in this huge debt. Being the case where a lot of our students are, do you think that would you be open to making this in some cases that the third session, if it was needed, that it would be covered under this bill?
My understanding, and you can correct me, is that Lutheran Social Services did have those third sessions, and they were just covering that under other means within their budget, not coming from this grant program. Our focus was on trying to increase the number of borrowers we were able to see, even at two sessions, and kind of extending, you know, our reach that way with whatever dollars were allocated through the budget process. So I guess you could look at it, you know, either way, more sessions to fewer or reaching more people with two sessions.
Bernardi?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like Lutheran Social Service to comment on that and the impacts it has on your program, or how could you see it, this bill, to be better to serve our students.
Right. I was going to look at my... Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The numbers in the pilot were relatively low of having a third case, and so we were trying to reach more individuals than, as Representative Haley said, with some of that information. And we do try to follow up and provide that help for folks with real complex cases. But looking at other sort of funding to cover some of those gaps, but it wasn't a significant amount that needed a third appointment.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you identify any lenders that you've had problems with, where loans have been consolidated and your clients have not been able to refinance their student loans?
Ms. Grimes or whomever?
Mr. Chair, how shall I say this? The Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently came out with a study that said loan servicing by a company called Navient that does a great deal of the servicing. It used to be called Sallie Mae. That there were significant problems with the loan servicing they did. And they have laid out some pretty specific changes that they want to see in order for those companies to continue to be contractors with the federal government. I do want to also mention that the Office of Higher Education does have a new student loan refinancing program where students who have higher interest rate loans, which are often private loans, or older loans at the 6.8 and 9% interest rates are eligible to get their loans refinanced through the Minnesota Self-Loan Program at a lower interest rate.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So how many cases, clients, have you helped that are in that have problems with Navient or situations? Have you had any experience with that?
Chair Nornes, Representative, we do see issues with servicers, especially not being in communication. There's been situations where, for example, we saw a woman who was in an income-driven repayment plan and didn't receive that notification that they needed to turn in some annual income verification documentation. So then her loan went into delinquency again, was at risk of default. She was being threatened with garnishments when there was really a lack of communication that could have been prevented. So she was able to get in with the financial counselor. They contacted the servicer together. Within an hour, they got the appropriate, she understood what she needed to do and was able to avoid that default and garnishment. So there are issues that we're seeing with servicers. Usually with the right, knowing the right people to talk to and what the right steps to take are, which is what our financial counselors have extensive training and experience in, they're able to help borrowers in those situations.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've had constituents with problems with this company, and it's taking a long time. Like, two sessions is probably not enough to deal with some complex situations like that. Mm-hmm. So how do you handle those cases? It sounds like you've had at least one case like that.
Oh, certainly.
Representative.
Yes. Chair Nornis, Representative. Yes, we do work with those borrowers in complex situations, and there's several of them. So we will help them until they resolve their issue. But most people we serve, out of the 981, they're usually one or two appointments. So they're able to get their questions answered and move forward with their action plan. But we don't leave them hanging and close the door if they can't. There's small amounts of funding from local United Ways or other donations, philanthropic donations that I work at covering some of those budget gaps where funding isn't supported for some of those situations, and that's what I try to do. Thank you.
I'd like to back up the issue that Representative Bernardi had raised and Mr. Williams.
Chair Norris, Representative Bernardi, I just wanted to bring your attention to the language in the bill relating to the number of counseling sessions. So the bill's language says that a goal of the counseling program is to provide two counseling sessions to at least 75% of borrowers receiving counseling. So I don't think that there's actually any language in the bill that would prohibit the organization that receives a grant for this program from providing more than two counseling sessions. It just says that the goal of the program is to provide at least two.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Chair. Given your experience in the pilot program and then how we're looking forward to if we expand it, what age are the students in? Are they recent graduates, or are these people that are a few years out and still struggling?
Chair Norris, Representative Pryor, we have the data on all of the age of the borrowers in the report that was published, and if you look at page 8, over half the borrowers were under 34, but we did see and there is a growing issue with student loan debt rising with individuals who are over 40, over 50. So the details are specifically in the report.
I'm not sure that we have the report.
Right. But I'll go back to my office and read it, I promise. And then you were saying too that you anticipate them, that you actually anticipate even that older students will be coming in and needing this counseling. So they're beyond the years where they were part of an institution and attached to an institution and are now still continuing with debt.
Mr. Chairman, there are cases where people go back to graduate school in midlife and end up with difficulties repaying their student loans, and there are also cases where people who are over 60 may have co-signed a loan or still be paying on a loan from earlier in their life where they also get into difficulty. It's not real common, but it does happen.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I could add on to Representative Pryor's question. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did recently come out with some statistics around seniors in debt, that it has quadrupled in the past 10 years. And the case that I was just stating around the servicer, that individual was a 64-year-old who was had gone back to school for a PhD. So that was we are seeing that. But in the details of the report, 22% were between ages of 25 and 29. 25% were between ages of 30 and 34. 15% between the ages of 35 and 39. 9% between the ages of 40 and 44. 7% were between the ages of 45 and 49. Then 50 to 54 was 5%. 55 to 59 was 4%. And then over 60, we had 5%.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Representative Haley, anything in closing?
I would just like to comment on Representative Podolsky's comment. I think that's something that we should look at and address in future conversations is the front end of this issue and what happens at the point where people apply to the state grants and the federal grants. So I'm happy that we have this solution on the back end, but I recognize that's a big concern.
All right.
Thank you.
We recognize the cookies. We really appreciate the cookies. And we don't expect that.
Yes.
Every day. Huh? The donut sounded actually like that.
I'll make a note of that, Chairman.
Okay. Anyway, appreciate the testimony and testifiers being here. The House moves at House File, the Chair moves at House File 794, as amended, delayed over for possible inclusion. So thank you very much. Members, anything else? Hearing none, the meeting is adjourned.